Welcome to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. My name is Fregal Byrne. Every fortnight, I speak to leading sustainability and environmental thinkers and practitioners, to scientists and economists, business leaders and investors, NGOs, as well as psychologists, writers, and artists. We discuss the sustainability imperative and explore the key environmental and sustainability challenges from a wide variety of perspectives. We explore the latest thinking, what's working, and new ideas in sustainability, resilience, and regeneration. The Environmental Justice Foundation is an NGO working to protect environmental security as a basic human right. Using powerful films and photography alongside hard-hitting investigations, EJF exposes environmental destruction and ensuing threats to human rights, telling the stories of those at the front lines. EJF takes local fights to the very heart of governments and businesses across the world to secure lasting global change. By providing training for grassroots campaigners, EJF also helps to give a voice to the next generation of environmental defenders, strengthening global action to protect people, wildlife, and our shared planet. I'm delighted to welcome John Elkington back to the Sustainability Agenda. Author, advisor, and serial entrepreneur, John is widely recognized as one of the founders of the global sustainability movement. He served on over 70 board and advisory boards and is credited with coining influential terms such as green growth, triple bottom line, and people, planet, and profit. John is the author, co-author of some 20 books. His latest, Tickling Sharks, offers a memoir of his pioneering work in developing and promoting corporate sustainability. So thank you very much, John, for joining me once again on the Sustainability Agenda podcast.
Fergal, it's a great pleasure. I look forward to the conversation.
So just maybe before we discuss your latest book, Tickling Sharks, and your views on some of the things that are happening today in the world of corporate sustainability, can you maybe just introduce yourself, tell us a little bit about your background, John, and what you do?
Yeah, well, I can try. I mean, I've always said I've not got an elevator pitch. I can't sum up what I've done in a few seconds for people, but I've been involved this year for 50 years professionally in first the environmental and then the sustainability movements. The key focus of what I've done over that period has been trying to engage business and financial markets in those agendas. People like numbers. I've set up four businesses since 1978. They all still exist. The third one, which we set up in 1987, called Sustainability, is now owned by KKR. I've served on over 80 boards and advisory boards, and I've just got this 21st book coming out. So, but I'm still trying to work out what I'm going to do when I grow up, Fergal. So back to you.
No, I'm not sure about that. I think you've been doing such important work over so many decades. Yes, 50 years. Fascinating. Wonderful. Mm. Now, before we discuss the book, maybe also if you can just give us a little bit of a perspective. We're no shortage of interconnected environmental and other crises right now, which we're facing. And I just wondering, what worries you the most? You've been looking at this, you've been involved in this, you've been at the heart of this for 50 years. But in this particular moment, what worries you the most?
I think it would probably be that the climate science has been telling us that we're seriously off course for decades. And we've been beginning to catch up, but not nearly fast enough. And the same is true on issues like biodiversity and so on. But that's going to be aggravated, I think, significantly in the next 3 to 4 years by, firstly, some sort of global recession, but also the politicization of our agenda. It happened with ESG to some degree. First, that sustainability will not be insulated from that. The push towards right-wing governments in Europe and the United States, I think, are just part of a broader trend of pushback against our agenda. I think that's inevitable. I don't welcome it, but I actually think it's an invitation to us all to step up to a rather different level.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We can touch on some of the issues, kickback, I suppose they say, about ESG in the States, but also some other questions about the commitment of corporations to the sustainability agenda. Now your life has been deeply intertwined with sustainability advocacy and in many ways shaping today's corporate sustainability landscape. And I'm just wondering, how important is corporate sustainability and what's at stake here, John?
Well, it's an interesting question, Fergal, because when I started out in the 70s, the main focus of concern largely then was on substances, you know, DDT, PCBs, these sorts of things. And it was also then also on materials and products and the processes behind those products and the projects that were involved in developing the factories and other infrastructures that were needed. And I suppose if I've done anything over the years, it has been to open up the business side of all of that, to try and penetrate boardrooms and C-suites, as we now call them, in different parts of the world. But the point I've got to now is recognizing that after 35, 40 years of corporate responsibility, shared value, ESG, all of these great things, which focus largely on the company and to some degree on its branding and on its technologies and business models and supply chains and so on, we have a slight problem, which is that those companies taken on their own, they can, you know, some of them can be leadership businesses for a while, but it's still contingent on the commitment of individual CEOs and other business leaders. And so I think the next stage of this challenge is to raise our game yet again and go after markets. How do we design and redesign markets such that it doesn't come down to individual CEOs choosing to be good or not good or transparent or not transparent or whatever, but this is something that markets dictate. And that's where in the last sort of year to 18 months, I've been focusing a growing proportion of my attention and work.
Yeah, very, very important, essential topic, really, the role of markets. And hopefully we'll get to dive into that a little bit later in the interview. And again, not wanting to get ahead of ourselves here, but it might be a good moment also to just get a sense from your perspective, what do you think has been achieved, really, in the quest for corporate sustainability so far? I mean, how should we assess this? And I'm just wondering whether there may be a few milestones that you believe really shifted the needle, John.
Well, look, when a small group of people started this sort of exploration of what business was doing in this space and how senior people within companies thought, it was really difficult, firstly, to get access. Secondly, to even have them consider the idea at some point in the future they might produce some sort of what we now call a sustainability report. I remember somebody from Shell in the 80s telling me that Shell would never report because it was too big and too complicated. Now we have the Corporate Social Reporting Directive from the EU. We have well over 90% of major businesses around the world producing sustainability reports. So in area after area, I think we can point to progress, but there are second and third order challenges. So, for example, with all of this reporting, fantastic. Thank you very much, business, for doing that. But who is actually taking all of that data, all of that information, and turning it into usable market intelligence that will drive the systemic change that we need? And I think the answer is, at the moment, the supply side in terms of market information is seriously outrunning the demand side. So maybe AI will help on that front. Maybe a bunch of other things will help. But I think there's a gap there, which somehow we've got to fill. And it's not just in reporting. It's in other areas as well.
Reporting is, from a corporate perspective, them sharing stories, sharing information. It's not enough, is it really? Because we don't really have a good sense of, you know, whether or not that's true, what they're saying. And the rhetoric is pretty easy. But in terms of what corporations are doing differently, how their capital allocation decisions are changing, or more profound ways, that deeper ways, would you say that companies have really adopted and are acting out of a sustainability agenda?
Well, in a way, I think one of the most significant changes, and it began to happen about 8-10 years ago, was that you'd heard businesses talking for a long time about what's the business case for us doing this stuff around corporate social responsibility, ESG, all of this good stuff. And there was this moment where instead of just talking about the business case, which is important, we've got to know whether this makes sense or not in business terms, you started to hear, and it was partly the influence of the new economy and the billionaires that came out of that period and started to invest in philanthropy in this space. You started to hear people talking about business models, not just the business case, but business models. So not why should we do that, but if we're going to do it, how do we do it to the best effects? That, for me, was one of those moments where I could see the landscape starting to shift. There's another one, which is that I often say that in my mind, a business generation in terms of leadership is not 33 years as with a human being. It's about 6 to 8 years. And so there has been, in the period that I've worked in this space, a huge turnover at the people who've taught at the top of companies. And so the people who viewed people like me as communists back in the it was no joke. that old watermelon,
yes,
joke, you know, green on the outside, red on the inside, was very real for the generation of people who had come up in the time when communism was the enemy. And people who were sort of coming at this sort of environmental and green agenda from a sort of, as they saw it, anti-business, anti-growth, anti-capitalism perspective, it was very easy to be cast as the enemy. Now the change is that you've got much younger people, relatively at least, running these companies. And for them, just a couple of final points on this, for them, this is the agenda that they know that they're going to have to face. It's no longer an alien agenda. They know someone's going to have to do it, and it's probably going to have to be them. But this cultural context has shifted as well. And I've heard a number of director-level people, particularly in European companies, saying, you know, I'm genuinely getting beaten up at the breakfast table by my own children. And, you know, the question is, I'm slightly dramatizing for effect, but they would say, no, that my children are asking, when did you decide to become an eco-criminal? Because, you know, eco-anxiety is spreading. Younger people are increasingly concerned, not just about the issues, but the lack of what they see as effective action. So I think things have changed, but it's never fast enough. But I say to younger people, don't think that we do not look out over a transformed landscape already, because over the last 50 years, things have changed and changed profoundly. Now we've got to get even more serious.
Yeah, no, very, very, very interesting. And I do want to get a snapshot, a little bit of profile of those early days and of those discussions. But this is a very personal book, John, in many ways. I think I don't know how many books you've written or co-written, but certainly maybe a couple of dozen or 20. But in this, there's much more setting the scene, I suppose, in terms of your family background and so forth. Family stories connected to the post-war era. A somewhat adventurous childhood. I'm just wondering how do you think some of those early experiences fed into your commitment to sustainability and passion for environmentalism?
Well, it's true. I mean, it's my 21st book, and it's marking a sort of slightly pivotal stage. Age has never been terribly important to me, but on Sunday, no, Saturday, I think I reached 75, and the book made me think that in many ways, the last 50 years have set the sort of foundations. They've created the sort of the springboard from which we've now got to jump in a number of different directions simultaneously. And so, to your question about the younger years, I as I traveled around the world, and it's been true for the last 40 plus years, people have asked me, you know, why did you go this particular route? What was there a moment where you were knocked off your donkey and by a sort of shaft of light and whatever? Because they thought at that stage you had to be sort of on the borderlines of crazy to have gone that route. Well, which in some weird way was slightly true, because, you know, my own parents, you know, who feature at the beginning of the book, they went through the Second World War. He was a Battle of Britain pilot, then he went to Russia, then he went to India and Burma and so on. And his world was very different And my mother was also a driver for the army during the Second World War. And they sympathized broadly with my environmentalism. But I think it took about 20 years for them to properly understand that I wasn't going to be a merchant banker, which they wanted. I wasn't going to join the Air Force, as my father had encouraged. I was going to take a very different track. And it was a career path that didn't exist then. So one of the endorsements of the book from Tomo Noda in Tokyo says, you know, that there is in Japanese thinking this idea that the path becomes clear as you walk it when you look backwards, but you can't see the path going forward. And that's certainly been true of my world. And in a way, what I was trying to do in this book, which, as you say, has a stronger, much stronger autobiographical sense. It is a personal memoir, but it's also a manifesto in some way. So it's taking this last 50 years of professional work, the last 75 years of life. And I've been incredibly lucky because I sort of was at a malleable, open stage of my life in the 60s and 70s when the environmental movement was just finding its feet. So I grew up with that movement. And then I helped sort of pioneer the sustainability movement. So timing has been absolutely critical in all of this. And I think very often, you know, people have very little sense of where these agendas came from. And I'm just trying to explain a little bit of the deeper history, at least as I saw it. And at least so far, the response has been quite positive. I'm sure there'll be critical reviews, but I'm braced.
Yeah, you mentioned being seen as a communist or, you know, being anti-growth. At that stage, how did you present what you thought, the direction of travel, and how did you paint a picture of what sustainability would look like to a corporation, given the fact that they have a fiduciary responsibility to shareholders, which is very powerful? It's not a language or a set of values, indeed, which are embodied or was embodied in corporations at the time. So how did you address that, John?
Well, I think partly through just curiosity. I always said that I was born nosy. And so I started, when I was at school, my father having been a pilot, I was fascinated by aviation and by aircraft. And so I started to write off aged 11, 10, 11, so on, to particularly American aerospace companies and ask them for their catalogs, their aircraft and so on. And very often they would reply with these really extraordinary great packages of information. They probably thought I was about to buy, you know, the latest nuclear bomber or whatever. But no, that gave me some sense behind the products that we use every day or fly in or whatever, these companies. And I think from that point on, I was intrigued in that aspect of the business world. But when in the mid-70s, I started to write for New Scientist, one of our magazines, and I wrote for them for about 5 years, doing something like a monthly feature article, and I would talk about particular companies. Because I had the New Scientist backing, I could go and see companies. Most of them at that stage were in the UK. And once I talked to one, then it was easier to get into the next one. But because of that writing, I was then asked to set up Environmental Data Services with a small group of people, ENDS, in 1978. And it took us 9 months. Even though we had a parent company, Income Data Services, which was very well respected by business leaders, it took us 9 months, or took me 9 months, to get into the first company. But once that set of doors had started to open, within 18 months, 2 years, I was being asked to help, for example, BP write its first environmental policy statement. So it went relatively quickly. But there were still vast numbers of companies just who thought this was completely alien, didn't want any part of it, and were quite happy that a few leadership companies would dabble with it. So I look back at that time period and the challenges that we faced in even getting access to companies. And I look at today's world where you get to see director level, board level people almost at the drop of the hat, and people take it for granted. I still don't.
No, it's interesting that you say that, and I'm just wondering how you framed it. You weren't talking about scope three emissions. You know, how did you frame it in terms of those discussions? I guess it varied, didn't it, in terms of people who were more on board for different aspects of it and so forth. In some ways, and certainly at that time, was seen standing a little bit in stark opposition to, you know, making profits.
Well, let me take two examples. And the first is English China Clays, which I went to see in 1977, I think. And they had a huge, great series of holes in the Cornish landscape. No doubt you visited them. And one of those holes is now the Eden Project, thanks to Tim Smith's work. But when I saw it, it was just this sort of catastrophic, great ulcer in the landscape. And they were just beginning to try and reclaim some of the spoil heaps because there'd been the Aberfan disaster. And looking back at that time, so much of the change agenda was driven by disasters, you know, Seveso, Chernobyl, Bhopal, these sorts of things. And in some ways, it's a horrible thing to say. I wasn't a vulture, but to some degree, I was riding on the back of that. And I was saying, you know, if this has happened to asbestos, what's going to happen to your product? So I went to see English China Clays. They were quite keen to tell the limited story that they had around using Soe sheep to punch grass swards into these sort of sandy mountains. Tiny impact they were really making, but I wrote that up. And then that led to all sorts of other things. And one of them, this is the second example, was ICI, now long gone, but Imperial Chemical Industries, then, you know, probably bigger than BP at the time, and bestrode the global landscape and thought it would go on forever. And I was working for their then chairman, John Harvey Jones, Sir John Harvey Jones, and a lot of the people who ran companies at that stage were, you know, knighted or all, they had all the symbols and signatures of powerful people. But anyway, I was working with him. And at the same time, exactly the same time, my then company, Sustainability, was being sued by three different parts of ICI, their chemicals, their PVC business, and their paints business. Because although I'd started to work as an advisor, a consultant to business, I was still an activist. I was still a campaigner. In 1988, we did a book called The Green Consumer Guide, sold 1 million copies in very, very short order, and had an enormous impact on business, which is what these ICI subsidiaries were responding to. And it caught them completely by surprise because they had a group environment advisor, and I'd worked with him for a number of years, and he was utterly focused on Washington and Brussels and the regulatory environment. And bang, in we came from the consumer world. And as I say, took them by surprise. As it happens, we won all of those law cases. And we were also sued by Monsanto at the same time, which was even more frightening. But my role in all of this has not been neutral. I've often said I tried to be neutral and objective 15 years out from where we are today. So I'm going to say some things that you're not going to find terribly comfortable if you're a company working back in the 80s, 90s, or whatever.
How interesting. It's interesting also you mentioned the risk management side of it, and hopefully we can maybe talk about that a bit later, the movement, the risk management side of it, the CSR side, and then this for-profit side of it, you know, and seeing it as a possibly an engine of growth. And I think that's an interesting evolution. But it's hard to believe, really, that the triple bottom line idea, that your concept and framework that you developed, is 30 years old now. What can you maybe just also set the scene a little bit of, you know, what was the landscape of corporate sustainability at the time, and what would you say its influence has been on corporate sustainability practices?
Well, thank you for the question. I'll attempt an answer, but before I do, I mean, if I've done anything over the years, one of the things I've done is to come up with language which somehow bridges the world that I'm most happy, or have been most happy with, the world of, you know, campaigners and activists and NGOs and so on, and the business world where I was initially trying to find a footing. So I come up with early 80s, the term of environmental excellence, which was then picked up by particularly the US chemical companies and petroleum industries and so on. Green growth, which I came up in 1986, has gone out into the language. And in that same spirit, the triple bottom line, I mean, it's odd now to say that it took me 18 months to get to those three words, but it really did. I mean, I'd looked at what was then the Business Council for Sustainable Development, now WBCSD, were doing, and they talked about eco-efficiency. And I'd worked with them, and I liked the concept, but the idea behind it was that companies could make or save money by doing the right thing on pollution control or waste management or energy efficiency or whatever. And I thought, well, you know, that's nice. And if it's an engineer, that's, you know, that's actionable. But there are these other dimensions there. And I want to try and get a piece of language that will properly encapsulate and help people think about those wider dimensions. So after about 18 months, I was really sort of banging my head against a brick wall. The three words, triple bottom line, dropped into my brain. And I was absolutely convinced that I must have read these words somewhere else. So I rang various people who I thought might have used them, trailed them, whatever, to find that it was novel. And then many years later, I always had this nagging feeling that somewhere I'd seen something equivalent. And one of the people who had a really big impact on me in the 80s was a guy called Alvin Toffler. And he wrote a book called Food Shock. Yeah. But he also wrote a book called The Third Wave. And I've always been very, very seduced by the idea that our societies, civilizations, societies, economies move in wave structures, not particularly predictable, but that. So I started playing with the idea and looking up backwards. And I found this book, The Third Wave, I don't know, about 8-9 years ago. And on about page 236 of the book, and I hadn't read it since 1980, was a subheading, and it said multiple bottom lines. And I thought, that's the catalyst, that's the spark, that's where it began. But thank you, Alvin Toffler. So I just very quickly, to explain the cultural context, I have a great friend and a colleague then, Jeff Lai at Sustainability. And when I came up with the triple bottom line, he really did not like the idea at all. And he was director level. And I won't say we fought each other tooth and nail for another 18 months, but it was difficult because he felt he'd joined an environmental organization. Here I was talking about economic, social, and environmental value created or destroyed. And then suddenly, after 18 months, Shell came to us, and we'd refused to work with them for 2 years after Brent Spar and the executions of Ken Saro-Wiwa and his colleagues in Nigeria. And we helped them do, almost tricked into doing the work, but we did this project, developing and launching their first ever sustainability report, which was a triple bottom line report. And because they were Anglo-Dutch, that took the triple bottom line into Holland, where it went berserk as the three P's. I'd come up with the people, planet, profit line in the year after triple bottom line, so that this would be in 1995. And then it went to Australia, New Zealand, and then it went to, you know, all over the world. So just finally, to your question, there are now over 8,000 businesses in the world, which, as you know, are certified B corporations. They all have to embrace the triple bottom line. You've got platforms like the Dow Jones Sustainability Indexes, which I was involved for the first 9 years. You've got the Global Reporting Initiative, where I was part of the founding group and then on the board for a number of years, which is also based around the triple bottom line. So it's out there. It's doing useful work. But we might discuss in 2018, I did the first ever, well, at least according to the Harvard Business Review, product recall of a management concept. That was the problem. that's another story.
Yes, very interesting. Very interesting. Now, you mentioned a couple of the early and UK examples. I mean, although ICI was an international company, in fact, my first job offer from business school was from ICI. what is apparent is that the personal side of this is tremendously important. We look very much at the corporate structure and the regulatory structure and things like that, and hopefully we'll talk a little bit about that before the end of the interview. But these personal relationships seem to be vitally important. And I'm just wondering, are there one or two conversations with these corporate leaders, sharks, I guess you call them, in the book that you think were pivotal in advancing sustainability? And I'm also interested, what was at stake for them to get aboard with the sustainability agenda at that time?
Well, what was at stake for them was face. I mean, in the sense that if they embraced the wrong agenda or the right agenda at the wrong time, that could blow up in their faces, and they would lose prestige. They would lose influence. They would be seen to kowtow to, you know, the Greenpeaces and the Friends of the Earth and so on of this world. But if I take one example, and you know, this is somebody I grew to respect enormously over time, but I tell the story in the book. It goes back to this John Harvey Jones story. These people were known as captains of industry. They were immensely powerful. They were surrounded by people who, like today's politicians, who protected them against the wider world and stuff that they didn't need to know or perhaps didn't want to know. And I was on the faculty at the World Economic Forum from 2002 onwards for 7 years. And one of the people I bumped into there, almost literally, physically, was Peter Brabeck-Letmath, who was then CEO, later chairman emeritus of Nestlé. And Nestlé was not a company that I particularly liked the feeling of. You know, they had been involved with a number of scandals, one of them the sort of baby milk controversy in Africa. So anyway, there was a breakfast in Davos. John Humphreys of the BBC was in the chair. Peter stood up, did his presentation. There were about 100 people in the room. I asked the first question, and I've become quite adept, I think, at asking challenging questions in a very friendly way. So I did it, and Peter responded really, really well. But the hosts were Infosys, the Indian IT company, who I got to know later on. But apparently they panicked, and they told John Humphreys, he told me later, through his earphone to shut the discussion down, because they said, if that's the first question, what God knows what's going to be the next one. So anyway, I felt Peter had responded well. And then about 3-4 months later, I was at the London Business School. I was doing a panel discussion, 200 people in the audience. I spoke first. Peter Brabeck was second, and then somebody else spoke. And partway through what Peter said, and he had a towering figure. He's a mountaineer. When you saw him sweeping in his limousine in Davos, he'd get out and he would be, you know, neck down to ankles, cashmere coat, an extraordinary character. So you didn't cross him lightly. Anyway, partway through, he said something that was just clinically wrong. And I thought, well, what do I do? Do I just shut up and wait until everyone's forgotten about it when we go to the discussion? So I just reached out and touched him on the elbow, turned to the audience and said, incidentally, Peter, that's wrong. And he stopped and turned to me and said, why? And so I told him why it was wrong. He said, I didn't know that. And I'll pay attention to that afterwards, got back to what he was saying. And afterwards, two of his colleagues who were in the audience ran up to me quite literally and said, you know, Mr. Brabeck does not like being treated like that. And I said, I don't care. I thought, because what he then did, the way he handled it, I thought was actually intelligent and actually useful. And I thought the audience would have gone away with the sense, you know, this man's worth, you know, paying attention to. And then 3 to 4 months after that, I got a personal call from Peter saying, would you join, John, would you join a new advisory board? And I said early on in this conversation, Fergal, that I've served now on over 80 of these boards and advisory boards over the years. It's been an extraordinary learning opportunity, great privilege. But in this case, I said, but that's what always happens. You know, I did sociology at university as one course. And one of the things you learn is the establishment, when challenged, pulls the threat. It either puts the threat, it kills it, or it puts it in prison, or it pulls it very close to the organizational, in this case, corporate chest, in hope of suffocating it. I said, that's not where I want to end up. This is what happens. So, but he said, but that's not the intent. And I said, okay, who else is part of it? And he said, well, professors, Michael Porter, C.K. Prahalad, he was then still alive, Jeffrey Sachs. And I thought, my God, with a group of people like this, we could do great work. So I joined. Mine was Nestle told me, they renewed my sentence, I think, three times, three-year terms. So 9 years, I hit the absolute maximum. But mine was by far the most challenging voice, the Nestle people told me in those meetings. But that to me was a time when it was almost like jousting. You had to go up against these very powerful people and challenge them and then deliver against the implicit challenge. I think that's got a little bit easier now. I think people are less likely to sort of default to whacking you around the head with a double-headed axe. I mean, they recognize that the external world has something to say, and they should be listening, regardless what they then do. There are a number of stories like this, because that was the game that we were playing, or at least I was playing at that stage.
Very interesting. I guess you're familiar with the idea of the Overton window. We now got the Elkington window, which is what opening the space for a discussion, what is permitted and not in an open forum.
I love that idea. I often use the metaphor of at one stage when I was a teenager, I took up weaving and dyeing. And in when you're dyeing wool, there is this thing called a mordant that opens up the fiber of the wool to allow the dye to come in. And I always felt that there was an element to what I was doing, which is like that. I was opening up business so that others could then come in. And so when people would say to me, tell us what Greenpeace or WWF or Oxfam would say on this, I said, well, I'll give you the headlines of what I think they would say, but for God's sake, invite them in. And if you want help with doing that, we'll help you. And we did.
Now, you mentioned earlier the question of the business case for sustainability, and this gets to the heart of a gnarly question, which is about profit maximizing corporations. And I just wonder, how have you or how do you respond to critics that say, well, you know, companies can never really be, you know, sustainable beyond maybe some superficial measures because they have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize their profits. And indeed, their internal systems and metrics, everything is predominantly profit focused.
Well, we swallow the neoliberal propaganda if we believe that businesses, particularly in the United States, only have a fiduciary responsibility to deliver a profit. That is their primary role in life, and it is a critical responsibility. But even people like Milton Friedman said, no, all of that holds as long as the business meets all of the relevant laws and standards and so on. And I, you know, although I've banged my head up against the Friedman agenda for a very long time now, I think he was a brilliant man. I think if he was alive now, he would reformulate some of his thinking in a way that was a little bit more sensitive to that wider world. So I think very often people say, well, we're in business, we can only do what the shareholders want of us. That's absolute bollocks, or perhaps I should use a slightly kinder term, but it's rubbish.
Do you really think that? I mean, yeah. Looking at the power of Delaware courts and the way in which they have historically sustained that argument about the importance of maximizing shareholder returns. I mean, it's complicated now, I guess, by Elon Musk moving from Delaware to Texas, and you're going to have something, that kind of thing going on. But we can talk about this. I mean, you were a key figure in the development of the GRI, and this is inevitably a longer journey, as it was with, I guess, financial accounting in the first instance.
Totally.
But there's a way to go, multiple different frameworks, complexity of trying to put financial values on environmental measures, so forth, all kinds of challenges, which you will know intimately. But within organizations, key metrics across the world are predominantly profit-focused. That has to be a huge constraint when it comes down to this question of the business case. Can you talk about what your experience has been and how you see executives dealing with that question today?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we all face is that business schools have been teaching the the Friedman religion or creed or whatever it is for many decades now. So, in a way, it's no surprise that whether they're Delaware listed or whatever, they're American corporations or they're operating elsewhere, this sort of absolute myopic focus on a single bottom line is now taken utterly for granted. So to your question about where have we seen companies doing things or businesses doing things, they have typically either been state-owned in some way, which gives them a bit more freedom of maneuver. They've been family-owned. I mean, just think of Patagonia, for example, giving over ownership of the company to Earth, at least by proxy. Or they've been mutants in some other way. Interface would be an example of that, or back in the day, Ben and Jerry's and Body Shop and so on. There would have been examples there, but just to be very clear, I have never said to companies, I want you to sacrifice. I want you to put on, a hair shirt. I mean, basically, throughout my career, the whole notion of green growth was there are these convulsions coming in our markets as we start to respond to some of these bigger social and environmental challenges and political challenges. And there are going to be huge growth opportunities opening up in those spaces. If you're blind to all of that, if you simply see this as risk rather than opportunity, you're going to lose out. And I think in a way, you mentioned Elon Musk. I remember working with Ford. I was working with Bill Ford back in the early years of this century. And I remember a session with about 20 engineers in their world headquarters at Ford. And I said, partway through the discussion, I said, this is a really interesting little startup company, which I'd like to know more about. It's called Tesla, and this is guy Elon Musk. And I still remember the reaction of these people, which was, I can't do the American accent, but we tried electric vehicles 100 years ago. It didn't work then. It's not going to work now. And look at the transformed landscape since. And I think that was, for me, one of those moments where you suddenly realize that there are assumptions that are invisible in most contexts that we make because of our business school training or our programming, because that we've been coached and schooled within particular companies to do things in a very particular way. And they blind us, which is one of the reasons why I think that when we look back in 10 to 15 years, that shorter timescale, many of the big incumbent known brands that we know will simply not exist any longer. I mean, they'll be owned by other businesses where the brands are still useful. But so many companies are on this trajectory where they think we're on a fairly mappable and understandable set of trajectories. And anyone who's looked at the work of groups like RethinkX, for example, Silicon Valley and UK-based, will know that we are seeing exponential shifts in technologies. Those mean exponential shifts in markets. And if companies do not go up those same trajectories or ahead of them, they will inevitably lose out. So that's risk, but it's also missed opportunity.
Yeah. But is that not a limited vision to say, yeah, sustainability, great if it makes you profits, but it raises questions about what role corporations really can have in, the sustainability agenda, dealing with the problems, the major challenges we have in the world. I mean, this is a fundamental question, I suppose. You mentioned the growth of B Corp and so forth. Are corporations as currently structured and, working with, shall we say, the Delaware legal underpinnings, are they fit for purpose to deal with the kinds of environmental, climate, and other challenges which many corporations are looking at today?
No, they're not. And, just to be clear, although I've helped pioneer the whole corporate responsibility and sustainability set of agendas, it was never part of my plan to simply hand over responsibility for this whole set of change agendas to business. They were simply blocking the path because of their lobbying and their advocacy and just their inertia. So let's get in there, into these companies, begin to destabilize them, not in a necessarily destructive way, but open them up to a rather different way of seeing the world and the future. And part of that, and one of the projects that our little change agency based in London, Valence, has recently been working in on both with Unilever in one case and with Porticus Foundation, is looking at the future role of businesses in influencing policy in these particular cases by trying to critically review the trade and industry federations of which they're members, and looking at the climate policies in this particular case of some of the key federations associations. So with Unilever, published work now, we did it with the Influence Map, it's very clear that about a quarter of the industry federations are simply arguing against the Unilever line. So what should Unilever do? And I think we're moving into a period where two things are happening simultaneously. One is our change agenda, whether we like it or not, is becoming politicized. You see it in Germany with heat pumps. You see it across Europe with farmers and, you know, wildlife and environmental protections. You see it in the US with anti-ESG. And the right-wing swing suggests that we will, in many of these geographies, will suggest that we see more of that. The question then is, what role can we expect business to play in politics? And I think they're going to have to play a more active, informed role, but I do not want them to become a dominant influence in politics because they're not democratically elected. They have their own axes to grind. So ultimately, the politicization of this agenda means that we've got to do politics in a different way. We've got to do new politics. And the showing of the Greens, Green parties in the latest EU elections is not particularly hopeful. But then in a way, most of the Green parties have been not fringe, but they've had a very much an anti-stance quite often. And I think we need sustainability relevant political parties which are more mainstream. Doesn't mean that they have to promote unfettered growth, but somehow we've got to make this more acceptable to ordinary voters, as we have to do with ordinary investors and consumers.
It's interesting that you'd hope that corporations might bring that kind of voice. Many, I suppose, would argue that already corporations, we see massive regulatory capture across the world. Yes, and you know, actually, surely what we should be looking for is more community-based organizations, more bottom-up organizations, more indigenous voices, more of that, and less of really the big, powerful organizations that are already have such an influence in the global economy in so many ways today in a political life.
Fergal, my heart says yes. I mean, I think indigenous peoples know their natural environments in a way that we could never hope to.
More than indigenous people, just community based, you know, something from the bottom up, something from, yes. And indigenous is a whole other discussion. But no, I mean, you know, yeah, absolutely.
Well, a final point, I mean, in a way on that, somebody I admired immensely from 1970 onwards, then met because I was on his board in 1990, was Dennis Hayes, who founded the Earth Day movement in 1970. And that time, 20 million in 1970, 20 million Americans went out in the streets and protested. It was a huge slice of the population. And because of that, a Republican president, God help us, Richard Nixon, passed into law the National Environmental Policy Act, founded the world's first environmental protection agency. So to your question, if we can get the grassroots, ground up movements playing into all of this in a constructive and effective way, fantastic. We absolutely need that. And I think the youth climate protests and so on, they may nucleate, you know, Greta and all the rest of it may nucleate new ways of bringing younger people's political voices into all of this.
In various ways, sustainability has had a slowdown, shall we say, or seems to have had a slowdown on the face of it, at least in a number of key ways. Are you concerned that sustainability might be overshadowed by the next management trend?
No, I'm not, in the sense that I think if we look back on today's world from 100 years in the future, sustainability as a concept would be up there alongside democracy, liberty, and these sorts of highfalutin ideas. But But in the short term, it's absolutely true that even within the sustainability space, you've had things like shared value, you've had ESG, you've had circularity, you've got regeneration, all of these different things, impact and so on, all vying for attention and oxygen and funding and so on. And I think that's one of the reasons why I think and it's healthy to have a competition of different approaches and ideas is inevitably healthy. But if you can't be coherent and convergent when it counts, and I think it's in the process of beginning to count enormously, then you're going to miss your opportunity to really drive the sort of systemic changes that we need to see in our world. And so I think sustainability has its ups and its downs. I think when everyone is using the term, I want to use anything but that term. we're in one of those moments at the moment.
That's a whole other discussion, unfortunately. Your dedication, John, your innovative thinking, I've had a huge impact on the idea, corporate practice, environmental stewardship, these kinds of areas. What are a few, would you say, crucial next steps to keep the momentum going?
Well, I think two things. Well, thank you for the feedback, Fergal. I really appreciate it. Because quite often when you're doing something like this, it's very hard to explain to others why you're doing it and why you're making them uncomfortable. And that, in a way, that's part of what my life has been about. But the two things that I think are coming up strongly, one is regeneration, not just biological and ecological regeneration, but also social and community, economic, and crucially political regeneration. So if we take that term as a system change manifesto, then I think we've got something really, firstly, very powerful, and secondly, less gameable. Sustainability, you know, you can slap sustainable on pretty much anything that moves, and people have been doing that. The second thing is that I think we've got to open out our focus from companies and businesses and so on, as I said earlier on, to markets. And I think the next phase of the challenge over the next sort of 5-7 years is to really look at the question, who in the world has worked out how to reconfigure markets such that they deliver the results that we need to see? And what can we learn in relatively short order from those people? And that's what I'm doing. I'm doing it in areas like insurance, in tax reform, in the legal regulation of companies, in all sorts of different areas. And if people are working in those areas and they want to continue the conversation, I'd love to do that.
What advice, John, do you have? If I'm sorry, one more final question for change makers, because I don't know how much you use that language, but that's really at the heart of what you've been doing as a change maker, as somebody who's introducing new ideas and helping pollinate. That's the word, isn't it? Pollinate change. What advice would you give for change makers who want to make a significant impact in today's world from your experience, John?
Well, I think several things. One is, it's going to sound glib to say this, but make sure that whatever it is that you're doing, you enjoy some critical parts of it. Because if it's not fun in the longer term, you're not going to stick with it and it's going to burn you out. So try and find something where you have an emotional engagement that is fed by the work that you're doing. Second is to pace yourself. I think we all feel that this has got to be done by next Tuesday, 3 o'clock or whatever. This is something that is going to take decades and even generations to deliver. And I had a lecture from my wife this morning, Elaine. We've been together now for 56 years, so something is working. But you're saying, trouble with you, John, is you're a missionary. You got this sort of, you know, bit between your teeth, and you want to change the world. So I'm arguing against myself in a way. If you can develop a family structure that is supportive, whether or not you have that, join networks of people who are not just like-minded, but broadly wanting to move in the same direction, because there's a lot of comfort that comes from that. And just watch for those signs of exhaustion and burnout, because these are such huge challenges. It's very easy to take the world's burdens on our shoulders, and we need to do that to some degree. But take care of yourselves.
Thank you, John. Thank you so much for all the work you've done over these many decades. and indeed for taking the time today to share the experiences, your experience, your insights, the ups and downs on your journey of sustainability. We spoke on this podcast 7 years ago now, so maybe we will revisit some of those crucial questions looking forward, at how the question of markets, the question of regeneration, nature-based solutions and so forth, which are really on the agenda. But thank you so much, and I wish you the very best with your ongoing work, John.
Thank you. We have a date for 2031, if not before, Fergal. A pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's discussion, we recommend you check out and support the work of Client Earth. Client Earth is an environmental law charity with a unique approach, using the law to create powerful change that protects life on Earth. To meet the global challenges facing our planet, Client Earth uses the power of the law to change systems for lasting change, informing, implementing and enforcing law and advising decision makers. Client Earth believes that a future in which people and planet thrive together isn't just possible, it's essential. You can find out more at clientearth.org.
Thank you for listening to the Sustainability Agenda podcast. I hope you found it interesting. It would be great if you could leave a review and share the podcast on social media. You can sign up at iTunes to make sure you don't miss any future episodes.